Arnold Schwarzenegger's six rules for success are: trust yourself, break some rules, don't be afraid to fail, work like hell, and give something back.
But I'll tell you, David works harder, if not, like, he works harder than anybody on this team. That kid comes up, he catches early bullpens every day, last one to leave.
The first time David Freitape stepped onto the baseball field, he was the underdog. From being told that he wasn't cut out for Little League, to taking a shot as a college walk-on, David used that negative energy as fuel and became the first known Lao American to play at the NCAA Division I level.
Talk about you. When you get you work hard, so when your opportunity comes, and that's the epitome of it. Did a terrific job right there.
That was a great team win. I saw him off the bag quite a bit, and I just swung it over there. In a big game, you got to make big game plays, and we had great pitching, tremendous defense, tremendous hitting, and it all came together pretty well, especially in that last year.
Behind his success was a supportive family that did everything they could to help their son stay on a successful path, all while learning to navigate through life in a new country and culture. David's baseball career is behind him, and he looks forward to giving back to his Lao community as a medical doctor.
You're the older brother, yes?
Yes, sir. I am the 2 years older of the brothers.
Okay.
Yeah, not too far off, but we have an older brother. He's 6 years older than me, so I'm the middle child.
same with me. Did he play sports? Did he play baseball?
He did.
The older?
No, he didn't. He actually did skateboarding and golf.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's
so three brothers in the family?
Yes, sir.
All athletic, huh? All doing athletics.
Yes,
that's
sir. Good.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
That's what we need to hear. That's what we need. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We had a very active household, so it was good. It was a good time.
See, guys, like me, we paved the way. We had to, like, do we got lectured on going to school and all that. So I had to rebel just to be a bodybuilder, you know. It was didn't get too much support, so it was a different road.
Yeah,
that speaks volume, because we definitely rebelled here, like, for a good amount at one point or another, whether it was me or was Davi or whether it was my big brother Boone. Like, we had our fair shares of trying to rebel against the educational part, but
you're still doing it, right? So you're a med student.
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, that's incredible. Well, if your brother's into skateboarding, I just say
when he opens up his practice, we go visit him in Florida.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'd love to have both of you. It'd be amazing.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Well, if your brother's into skateboarding, we're working with Pat Chinita to schedule. He was a pro.
Okay.
He was actually number one ranked WCS skateboarder in the world at one time.
Awesome.
Back in the day, he's more like my age, so a little before your time. Yeah, our age co, but
he was on Jackass.
Oh yeah, he was in Jackass.
No,
he was in all kinds of movies. Yeah, he was the man back then. So tell your brother to keep an eye out for that one. We just got to work out the scheduling with him. Like everybody, we got to balance it out. Well, hey, David, we're excited to have you on. This is a great follow-up to the interview that we had with your brother. A lot of folks liked that one. We got some good comments actually on that one that I'm going to share with you later in it. But Co's going to get us kicked off, Co.
Yeah. Hey, welcome everybody to another episode of C4 Podcast. My name is Coach Andetka, here along with my co-host John Messina. If you haven't already, give us a like, follow, and share. And, just listen to these amazing stories from some amazing athletes. So, as you know, we have another page, Lao American Sports Hall of Fame. If you haven't already, please like and follow that page and share it. And basically what it is it's a Hall of Fame page that recognizes Lao American athletes. But with the podcast, we took it a step further. We want to know the stories, and we opened it up to more, more to the Southeast Asian region. So without further ado, I'm going to pass it over to John.
Yeah. Today we have David Freitape, and David is the older brother, as he was telling us earlier, to Dave. So if you haven't listened to our episode with Dave Freitape, please do. Dave is a former Division I baseball player, now getting his PhD in clinical psychology, specifically around athlete performance and mental health. And we had a great time talking to him about that, but we wanted to round out the whole story on the Freitape brothers and invite the first known D1 D1 baseball player with ancestry from Laos. And we have him on today. So David, go ahead. And I know David is kind of a name you go by, but tell us your full name. And then, you know, we only kind of touched a little bit with your brother on the family background, but our listeners love hearing the stories of where people are from Laos and them coming over and how maybe your parents grew up, because they were kind of in that, I call it, it's referred to as maybe the 1.5 generation, right? Came here young enough to kind of, you know, Americanize and go to school here, but we're still, I think, born over there. Kind of like Co's a good example
of that. That would be me.
You, my wife.
I didn't know there was a name for it. What am I calling it again? The 1.5?
Yeah. Your parents are like one, right? And then like David is two, right? Because he's born, raised here.
It's almost like a hybrid, like the changeover.
Exactly. Anyways, and my wife's one of those too. So, but anyway, David, so tell us a little bit about your family's background in Laos, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. My real name is Devon, David Prattape. My middle name's David. I typically go by David. In the Laotian community, I go by Devon. So kind of a hybrid, either one will work. My little brother touched on it earlier. My mom is from Luang Prabang. She moved over to California, and then my dad is from Vientiane, and he moved to Rhode Island. Before they moved to the States, my parents were actually went by boat to Thailand, and then from Thailand they came to the States. And for the most part, what my brother said, they met at a family reunion type deal. My mom became a registered nurse in Rhode Island, and then my dad got his electrical engineering degree at URI in Rhode Island as well. My dad ended up getting a job in St. Petersburg, Florida. He ended up working for like a Fortune 500 company here in St. Petersburg. And so pretty much electrical wiring as well as programming. So like he would come home randomly on days and he'd bring like a BlackBerry. And we'd be like, whoa, like, how did you get a BlackBerry? He's like, oh, I made this. And it wasn't just like a regular BlackBerry. It was souped up. It had like a BlackBerry with a massive battery pack that could last for like 2 days. Or then he would bring home like, and just like any little electronic device that he like got his hands on, he would just almost amp it up to the next level. And then my mom, she ended up working here at a local hospital in St. Petersburg. She worked in the intensive care unit at the hospital. And then she switched over to emergency medicine in the ER. And that's actually a really important tidbit because it'll explain a lot of things as to why I decided to choose the career that I chose. But she became a charge nurse. She worked her way up. She's a charge nurse now in the ER. And she always says, they call me General Chan. So I believe it. She is the general of that emergency room. And she's a big inspiration for me. And I even joke about it to her to this day. Like, if she were to be born here in the States, I firmly believe she'd be a doctor right now. Like that, she has the it factor for it. And then my dad, it was just like, he did electrical engineering, but he was pretty much like a Renaissance man with his hands. Like, if it was broken, he could fix it, and if he couldn't fix it right then and there, he would YouTube it, and then he would fix it. So it was pretty cool to see it growing up, and like I think one thing, there's two kind of stories with my parents that like really stuck out with me, like growing up. And like one thing with my mom, when she was in Laos, she would, one of the things that she always had to find ways to make a living in a way, try to find ways to make money. And so one thing that she told me growing up is that she used to make food and then sell it to her classmates, like at recess. Like while everybody was playing games and stuff, she would have food and drinks and then her friends would come buy food and then she'd pack her stuff up and then go.
How old was she at this time?
She told me she was in her, like, I guess in elementary school, middle school. So kind of pretty young. So
I was like, entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Exactly. Yeah. And then one thing with my dad that's really stuck with me kind of is that he used to say like here in Rhode Island, when he was studying for his degree, he used to have like a dictionary, like a translating dictionary, English dictionary. And then the textbook, and he was deciphering the textbook with the English language and then trying to figure out the problem. And like that, I mean, I couldn't imagine what that was like, but I mean, that was, he made it through, so it was pretty inspirational.
Wow. Yeah, so he, when he went to college, he wasn't 100% fluent in English yet?
No. He wasn't like completely fluent. And I mean, I can't even fathom how that was. I mean, I struggle to read certain words, and I can't imagine not knowing the specific language and then trying to figure out what it actually means.
He was right. He was like the original Google translator.
Right, that's exactly.
Amazing. That's crazy.
Yeah, awesome. That is too wild.
That's yeah. He should get royalties for that, you know?
For real. I remember growing up too. I wasn't the best at math, but he was good at math. And so I would come home and I would have homework. And I'd be like, hey, Dad, I need help. And he would try to help me. And it wasn't sticking in my head. And he was like, you know, when I was growing up, I had dictionary in one hand, the book in the other, and like I figured it out. And then for me, I was like, I still don't understand it. So I need some more help. But it worked out in the end, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a small community. And if he grew up in Rhode Island, he might know Andre Sukumthot, who we had on, the MMA fighter. Andre's from Woonsocket and Providence. He kind of moved between the two. So we'll have to ask your dad if you ever met Andre. So
I'll let him know.
Yeah.
Are you guys familiar with Andre? I'm just curious.
No, sir. We are not, no.
You guys don't follow MMA?
No, not too much, but we should start for sure.
Well, I mean, if you go to the Hall of Fame page, there's a big line of, you know, athletes that, you know, from rodeo to, you know, bodybuilding, powerlifting, and that's what was, and that's how we found you guys, right? I mean, it's just like we kept on discovering there are some great athletes and they're all doing this sport and that sport, and you know, that's what makes it so cool, you know. But I guess we're a little bit older.
Yeah, well, cool. Well, anyway, so tell us a little bit about growing up. You talked about rebelling a little bit, and your brother kind of touched on how you got into baseball, but maybe give us another overview of that too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so the backstory of what my brother said is very true, but the underlying what I went through was in first grade I had this friend, his name, shout out to Stephen Cantrell, he was one of my really good friends, and he was like, one day I asked him, one day I was like, hey, you want to hang out after school today? He goes, oh no, I have baseball practice. And I said, oh, what's baseball? He's like, oh, you don't know what baseball is? And I was like, no, I don't. And he goes, oh, just come with me to practice. It'll be fun. And I said, okay, but I got to ask my mom. And so I asked my mom, and my mom goes, what's baseball? So what ended up happening was my mom talked to his mom about what baseball was. And then we ended up coming to the conclusion, like, okay, I'll let David go play baseball. And so my mom being my mom, I love her to death. She bought me a red plastic glove, like at Toys R Us, like, but she got it at like a flea market essentially. So it was like not an actual leather glove. It was like something you play with, like a wiffle ball or something, I guess.
Okay.
You could say. And so I show up to practice with my friend, Steven, and we're playing catch, and the ball keeps hitting my glove and it keeps falling out. It keeps hitting my glove and falling out. I'm throwing it back. Ball keeps hitting my glove and falling out. I'm like, man, I thought I was doing, like, I'm looking around, everybody's catching the ball, sticking it, and mine keeps falling out. The coach comes up to me and goes, hey, your glove. And I was like, yeah, my mom got it for me. He goes, that's a toy glove. And I was like, oh man. So after practice, that coach ended up talking to my mom and was like, hey, like, you know, your son has like a toy glove. And my mom turned beet red, and she's like, oh my gosh, I didn't know all this stuff. And then, well, the next day, she went to like play it against sports. It's kind of like a used like sports shop here in St. Petersburg. And she got me like a cheap like leather glove. And ever since then, I kind of started playing. So it was cool. That's kind of how I got into it. And the thing is, though, I started playing. I wasn't the greatest. I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. I just want to hang out with my friend. And so the coach, after one day, he goes, hey, like, he came up to my mom, actually, and was like, hey, like, your son's not really progressing too well. He's not, like, playing up to speed. I was like 8 or 9 at the time. So, and then he was like, your son might have to go play T-ball. And when you go play T-ball, like those kids are young. Those are like 4 or 5 year olds. And with the little knowledge I had about baseball, I knew that fact that I was not 4 or 5 and I shouldn't be hitting a baseball off the tee at 9 years old playing with kids. And then ever since then, I was like, I begged the coach. I remember I was begging. I was like, please let me play. Like I'll do what it takes. Like I'll play, like I'll make sure I can play. And he said, okay, fine. You have this season to play. It's like, okay. And then like ever since then, I just grinded. Like for some reason at that age and that time period of my life, like it stuck with me. It stuck with me today. I remember the conversation. I can envision the coach and him telling me that, like, hey, you should go play T-ball. It just didn't sit well with me. And so I think that upbringing kind of was like the spark to my career in a way. And then after that, I played 9 years old, played 10 years old, kept playing, kept moving up, started getting like becoming a starter, being relied on in big situations, making the all-star team. And then when I was 12, this was kind of like the next, like almost like milestone, more so big obstacle I had to face. I remember I was playing for a travel ball team and the coach came up to my mom and was like, hey, like your son, like it's not really throwing that hard. I was a catcher at the time. And like, we're 12 years old. Like we don't know any better. We're just like playing travel ball. And I remember him coming up to me and my mom. He was like, hey, like, we have this other kid. He came from a different area. He's a good catcher. Your son's arm just not good enough. He can't make it to second base. And I was like, yeah, I can make it to second base. And he's like, yeah, but like, it's not that fast to second base. And in that moment, I had two choices. I was like, I can move faster or I can throw harder. I tried doing both. And so at that point, my mom called the coach and was like, hey, we're thinking about leaving the team. The owner of the organization we were playing for called my mom and was like, no, I want your son to stay. He can be on this. They had an A team and B team. I was on the B team at the time. He was like, he can come play on my A team. And I was like, okay. He was like, but your son has to work on it. And I was like, okay, I can do that. And so my parents, I think one of the big things is they were very supportive of sports, but they never prioritized education over sports. And in that moment, my parents were like, is this what you really want to do? Is this something that you want to actually pursue? I said, yeah, I want to. And they're like, well, school comes first. I said, okay, that's fine. And so I worked, I trained. My dad, he actually built a batting cage in our backyard by his hands. He just looked it up and then ended up buying the supplies, making a batting cage. And I remember after school, every day, I would have to finish my homework first and then I can train. It wasn't ever, I can train and then I can do homework later. And so it got to the point where he bought like weighted balls. Looking back on it, this is probably not the most healthiest of ways to strength train when you're 12 years old, trying to, with the one, like with your arm developing and throwing heavy balls at max velocity, like 18 reps plus, and just like trying to just air it out. But that's what I did. That's what me and my little brother did. We went in the backyard, we threw these heavy balls, and my dad would be like, all right, you have to hit this target multiple times, and then we can move on to the next thing. And sometimes we'd be out there until the lights turned off, like the sun went down. My dad would get this big lamp that he had, be out there, and we would get so mad because sometimes we just wouldn't be able to do it. And I'm getting chills just talking about this because this is like a core memory. I remember him like coming up to us and be like, hey, coming up to me, and it was like, hey, just quit. And I was like, just quit? What do you mean? Because I was getting mad, and that was one thing that my parents did not tolerate. If I had to be faced with adversity, I'm not allowed to show that I'm upset. I'm also not allowed to throw my equipment. That was a big no-no in our household. If you get mad and you start throwing equipment, it's a red flag. And so I started throwing my equipment. I started throwing my gear. He said, all right, fine. You're not going to practice tomorrow. Find a ride. Find something. you're not going. I said, what do you mean you're not going? You're not going. You decide to act out the way you act out. You're not going to practice. And I took that to heart. And I wouldn't say it was always easy, because there would be days that I would come home from practice or games. I'd be 0-for-3, 3 strikeouts. I'd be mad. My parents would be like, all right, you guys still got to go to school. You still got to do well in school, all these things. And I think one of the, like, the common theme that I kept having growing up was, like, why can't I do both? Like, why can't I do both? Why can't I play baseball and go to school and do well in both? So that's kind of my upbringing in a sense. But we did play varsity baseball. And my little brother was like, and my mom, dad, and my big brother, my little brother, like, there's a big family support system. Like, it took a village to get to where we were. Like, I remember, I can envision, like, my mom and dad sitting in right field line outside the fence. My dad recording us every single game. We would watch us how we did. Even if it was bad, it would be brutal if it was bad. But it's kind of how it was. And it wasn't until, like, high school that we really thought about, like, oh, wow, we can really make something out of this in a way. But, yeah, that was kind of the upbringing as far as my childhood. That's kind of core memories that made me who I was.
Yeah,
that's cool. I mean, the support system is very important, mm-hmm. you know, so you guys definitely benefited from that. And very happy to hear that your parents, you know, didn't say one or the other, didn't say mm-hmm. school or baseball, but you could do both, you know, but school mm-hmm. takes the priority, then you can go out and train. I think that's pretty, that's mm-hmm. pretty awesome for them to allow you guys to do that.
It was tough. It was a lot of long nights, a lot of balancing through identities. Like, do I want to just do well in school, or do I really love my friends that I have teammates that play baseball? And it was part of my identity. I mean, part of my friend group, part of my socialization, like literally part of my mental health, honestly. Like, I'd have a rough day at school. I knew that I was going to baseball practice. I could just let it out. But I could also, to that same token, if I did bad at baseball, then I could have school to let it out in a way. So it's kind of like a twofold dynamic.
Yeah. So then when you got up to high school, you started getting recruited by colleges. Tell us a little bit about that process and how you ended up choosing to go to UCF, University of Central Florida, over some of the other options you had.
Yeah. So my story growing up for baseball and high school is really, really interesting. So growing up in high school, like, I didn't have really anybody to turn to as far as how the recruiting process went. What do coaches really like in a player? What are the resources out there? Here in Florida, like, if you're a really good player, you go play for the big name teams and you play the big bucks and go play in the big tournaments where scouts go. I didn't really have that growing up. I mean, there was teams that I'd play on and we would go to big tournaments, but that was like a one-shot deal. I didn't do well that tournament, wasn't getting recruited. And so one of the things that my parents and I decided to sit down and talk about was like, hey, like, go to these almost weekend showcases at the school and go show them what you can do right then and there on their campus. And so we kind of did that. And this is kind of where the rebellion of me came in. I would go to, like, the University of Florida showcase. I remember this. I went to the University of Florida showcase. I did really well on it. Coach came up to me and was like, hey, like, we like you a lot, but we want you to develop. So we want you to go to our junior college that's affiliated with our school. Go develop there. It's called Santa Fe College. Great, great institution. And then go develop there. And then see where you are in 2 years, and we'll see where you're at, and we might just have you come to our team when you're a junior. I said, okay. Get me in contact with the coach. Got me in contact with that coach. I presented it to my mom. I was like, hey, mom, dad, I have this school that wants me. And they're like, what school is it? I said, Santa Fe College. You go, is that a 4-year university? I was like, no, it's not. And they go, well, then tell them no. And I was like, this was one of the first opportunities I ever had. And I was like, I can't just tell them, no, I want to go play baseball. And like, no, you have to go to a four-year university. We want you to prioritize education. And so I told the coach that. I was like, I literally remember the text. I was like, hey, coach, I talked to my parents. My parents want me to go to a four-year university. The coach texted back and said, let me talk to them. We're a great program, all these things. So I told my mom and dad that. They're like, no, you're not going. I said, okay, fine. So I went to another camp at FSU. Same thing happened. Tallahassee Community College wanted me to go to their system, move into the FSU system. Parents said, nope. So, well, what do I got to do? And so I went to Brown University. I went to their showcase. They told me, they're like, all right, we want you. We want you to come to our school. You just have to make the SAT benchmark, because it was an Ivy League. And so I was like, okay, fine, I'll do it. So I studied really hard, took it three times, didn't get it. And guess what? That coach never contacted me ever again. And that was like the dagger for me. And this was like senior year of high school. All my friends, all my teammates, like they're committing. They're committing to big name schools. And I was one of few on our team that was projected, I guess, quote unquote, to like go play. I was the only one that didn't sign. And it's funny because my freshman year coach, he left when I was a freshman. He coached at a small, it was like NAIA, I don't even know how you call it, but it was a small Tennessee school. It was called Milligan College. And he said, hey, you come here, you'll start. We're a four-year school. I was like, okay, perfect. Signed letter of intent, I was gone. So this is end of senior year, and this was around June, July-ish. So this is right before school started. I went to orientation. I go to orientation. When I went to visit the college, it was snowing, so I didn't really get to see the college. I didn't really get to interact with anybody, didn't interact with nobody. And the day I stepped foot for orientation, like life changed. I looked around the room where I was looking at my freshman class and like, hey, what are you here for? I was like, oh, I'm here to play baseball. Like, oh, cool. Nice. There was 50 of us. There was 50 of us in the room. We were the freshman class. I had no idea that this school was like that. I'm very open-minded. I just wanted to play baseball, honestly. And I remember one of the kids, the leader of the group, was like, oh, so like, tell me something that you want to do. And I was like, oh, I'm here for playing baseball. Another kid was like, oh, I want to be a pastor when I grow up. I was like, oh, okay, that's awesome. Very cool. Very cool. I go to sign up for classes, and I was like, and they're like, what do you want to major in? I was like, oh, something biology. I kind of want to go to medical school. And they're like, all right, so you got biology, intro to Bible study, intro to another Christianity class, and then you also have to volunteer at the chapel for 4 hours every week. And so I'm in my student cohort, and my parents are in another with all the other parents. And so what ended up happening was I didn't realize when I signed the letter of intent that it was a religious school. My coach never advertised that to me. He said, you'll start, you'll be a freshman All-American when you come here. You don't have to worry about anything. And it felt off. It really did. And I told my coach that night, I sat down with my parents and I told that coach that night, I was like, hey, like, I don't remember you mentioning any of this to me. And because we had a good relationship because I played for him my freshman year of high school. And he goes, yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, this is what our school is about. And I said, how many students go on to like medical school from this program? He goes, I don't think we've had any before. And I was kind of like, oh man, I don't know if I signed up for this. And so my parents, we ended up traveling back down to Orlando, and we kind of came to the conclusion that I wasn't going to go to that school anymore.
This is in July. School starts in August, and I don't have a college to go to anymore. So my mom picks up the phone, starts calling University of Florida, Florida State University, all the schools I got accepted to just for purely academics. The only schools that accepted me was St. Petersburg Junior College at the time and University of Central Florida. And so my mom said, do you want to stay at home or you want to go to Orlando for school? I said, just get me to Orlando. I'm okay with going to Orlando. And she's like, okay, since we're in Orlando, let's go see the, go drive around, go see the school. It was pouring raining when I went to go see the school. And I remember being on the phone and my mom goes, hey, like, how's it look? And I just see rain just falling down. I'm at the entrance of the school. And I go, it's good, sign me up. I didn't even look at the school. I didn't do anything about the school. The one funny fact of this whole thing was I actually went to a showcase at UCF when I was a junior and I did really bad, like really bad. And I remember that day, I was like, I never want to go to this school ever again. The coach is going to remember me. I do not want to go to the school. It's not going to work out. Freshman year comes, since it was the only school that accepted me, I didn't play baseball. I just did like club sports. I played club baseball just to feel it again. And I was like, I don't want to play like actual, like competitive organized baseball at that level. And I remember my mom called me. I wasn't feeling the greatest. My mom called me. She goes, it was like the end of my freshman year. And she goes, hey, like, do you miss baseball? And I was like, yeah, I do. She goes, how about next? She was like, ever thought about like trying out? I said, no, not really. I didn't want to go to this school in the first place. The coaches will remember me. And then I was like, she was like, you should try it. And that's honestly all I needed. I just needed to hear my mom say, you should try it. And that sophomore year, I tried out and I walked on. And that's a whole different story. That's a whole different beast, but that's kind of how I got there.
Yeah. So with that, we had one of our listeners, he's got a son who's a high school baseball player. I'm just going to read a comment from him that he gave us after your brother's interview and just like to hear your take on it. He says, this is from T. Chris. So thanks, T. Chris. Some good stuff here and hope to see more Lao people in baseball. Like Dave's parents, I also think academics should take priority over baseball when it comes to choosing where to go. My son is a freshman in high school and is currently being courted by D1 SEC schools. He is a pitcher. He's interested in exercise science as a major. So what would you tell T. Chris and his son regarding, you know, there's some big schools after him, all kinds of different levels of academics probably coming his way. What advice would you give him?
I'd say stay level-headed, enjoy the process. You're a young kid. You have programs already looking at you that you've already fought half the battle. The next battle is to actually execute, perform, and do well in school. Because talent just doesn't happen overnight. There's a reason why someone's looking at you. Like you don't go from like novice to elite in like 2 days. Like there's a progression that someone has to really like buy into, and that's why schools are looking at him. Like they see something in him that is potential, and whether he capitalizes on that potential or not, that's up to him and his family. And I think academics does come first, but you can also be a baller and like really make a name for yourself if you do the right things really well. If anything, it should give a motivation to grind harder. Being a freshman, you don't know how to drive yet. You don't even know what high school is like yet. There's a lot of things that can happen between that 4-year period that someone can be like, oh, I have these schools looking at me, but a lot can happen in those 4 years to where you might not have those schools ever looking at you ever again. And so there's a track record that there's a price to pay when it comes to being an elite or just being a student athlete. You're representing the program, you're representing your family, you're representing yourself, and you get mixed in the wrong crowd, you get mixed in the wrong people, you get mixed into the wrong ambitions, goals. That one school, those two schools, those three schools that were looking at you freshman year, could turn to zero very quickly in a matter of a decision. Whether you decide not to go to class anymore, whether you decide to fall asleep in class while the teacher's talking, whether you decide the teacher that was going to write you a letter of rec doesn't like you anymore because you decided to act out in class, that's enough of a reason for a university not to take you. And just because you're good at baseball doesn't mean you'll be a fit for the school, or doesn't mean you'll be a fit for their academics. So yeah, I would say that. It's amazing.
So we look forward to seeing how he does. And you know, my daughter, she just started her freshman year at University of Pittsburgh as a Division I athlete, a swimmer. Nice. And, you know, I'll just reiterate to anybody out there, the academics are important because it will keep your options open the better your mm-hmm. grades are to go to whatever school you want. Some will bend on academics, others won't. So, mm-hmm. yeah. So with Absolutely. That, so tell us a little bit about being a D1 athlete in your time at Florida.
It was fun. It was the most shaping experience of my life. It's made me the person I am today. I'd be lying to you if I said it was easy. Being a walk-on, I was constantly for my sophomore year, being a walk-on, I was constantly on the chopping block. I literally had nothing to my name. I had to find a way to be an asset to the team, whether that was being a workhorse in the weight room, doing well in school, performing on the field, because they don't just let anybody be on the roster. You have to perform at a high level with the guys that you're competing against. And I remember I would think everything was so minute to the point where I would stress myself out. I would, if I walked the wrong way, if I talked the wrong way, if I didn't finish a rep, I always thought I was getting cut. To that same token though, it made me appreciate every time I walked on that baseball field because I knew it was going to be potentially my last day ever. And when I was on the walk-on trail, so what happens is I go to walk-on tryouts in September, right now. Actually, now would be walk-on tryouts. And there is, at my school, we're one of the largest universities. There's 60,000 plus kids at our university. And I remember there's 50 plus other athletes fighting for the same two roster spots for walk-ons. And that's just walk-ons. There's a 35-man roster. It doesn't mean everybody's going to make it to the end. And I had to separate myself. I remember I wore a green Hurricanes jersey. It's orange and green. And can't miss it. And I did it on purpose. I was like, if I'm showing up to this tryout, they're going to know me. They might know me because of my performance, but they're gonna know me as the kid that showed up in a rival university's colors to our tryouts because we're black and gold. So I didn't wear any black and gold. So I didn't want to blend in. I wanted to stand out. I wanted them to know that I was there. I meant business. I was there to make a roster spot. And I remember every day I went to the baseball field thinking it was my last day, I didn't take it for granted. I talked to everybody with the same intensity as I did with my coaches. I treated every staff member with the same intensity as my teammates because I didn't know how it was going to be brought back to the coach. They could have been like, oh, you're a walk-on player, talked rude to me today. It could have been the last straw. They could have been like, ah, all right, cool, you're off the team. And during my walk-on trial, so tryouts were, you make the first cut, and then you go through a whole fall and spring tryout. So I had to perform throughout the whole season leading up to opening day, and they didn't let me in the locker room. That was an apparent thing. They didn't let me in the locker room, and so I would show up in my green Hurricanes jersey after class, and I would sit in the stadium and with my backpack, my baseball bag and everything while they started practice. And then I would wait and then they'd be like, all right, you can come practice with us right now. And so I would sit there for a good majority of time waiting for them to give me my shot. And that was my reality throughout my walk-on process. And it was hard. I enjoyed every bit of it, but it was hard. I had those teammates that I call family now, before we're strangers. Like, they'd be like, oh, yeah, I remember you. You were just sitting there. Like, just like we were waiting for you to make the team because everybody's like, who is this kid that keeps coming to practice? And it got to the point where they ended up giving me the roster spot. I remember the first time they let me in the locker room. I should have kept this. But, you know, the masking tape, like you put like the yellow tape that you would put on like construction work or anything.
Caution.
Yeah. Kind of like caution tape. It had my last name in Sharpie on the locker. And that was my locker. That was like my initiation of like, all right, you made it this far. Here's your locker, but you're not on the team yet. And I didn't have any equipment. They didn't, because at the university at a Division I level, they provide you equipment based off the sponsor of the team. I used my own equipment, used my own everything. And I was like an outcast in a way until opening day started. And I finally got the, hey, you made the team. And that, I can't take it for granted. That was an amazing experience because when I first started playing baseball, I didn't think anything of it. I just wanted to be an inspiration for myself, for my family, honestly, for Davi. He was one of the biggest driving forces as to why I even kept going. Cause I never grew up with a role model in baseball, like an actual tangible role model. Like I idolized Ichiro, but like I've never met Ichiro. I've never had a conversation with Ichiro. He was just like a peripheral figure that I looked up to. But for me, I wanted Davi to have someone he could look up to be able to do the same thing. And it was a culmination of a lot of pent up, like suppressive memories growing up. It made me feel like it was all worth it. But playing on a Division I team, it was hard. Like there was a lot of expectations that needed to be met. You had to go to study hall hour every Sunday for 2 hours. You had to wake up at 6 a.m. and go to workouts, whether you liked it or not. And if you were late, everybody's running. There was no question if, ands, or buts about it. Someone misses class, everybody's running. And so there's a whole part of accountability leadership that I learned. And since I was a catcher, I had to epitomize that in a way. As a walk-on, you don't want like a catcher that's really soft-spoken. You want a catcher that is going to call the plays and make sure that everybody's in their doing their roles right. And so I kind of had to do that to the extra mile so that they realized that I was meant to be there. I deserved to be there. And so I was kind of constantly like in the back of my mind. Workouts were tough. I wasn't the best in the weight room at the time. And I remember one of my trainers, I don't know if he did this as a scare tactic for me, but he came up to me. I was shoulder pressing because I didn't work out before this. So I was shoulder pressing like 35s. All my teammates are shoulder pressing like 60, 50. And he comes up to me. He just whispers in my ear and goes, hey, you should probably lift heavier if you want to stay on this team. And for some reason, that just lit so much under me. And ever since then, I took the weight room seriously. I took my nutrition seriously. And I ended up lifting a decent amount of weight. I wish it translated to the field a little bit more, but that's another story. But I just immersed myself in the experience, and it was a good time. I have friends that I would call family, things like that.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what was maybe your proudest moment on the field there at UCF?
Oh man. I think senior night was probably my proudest moment. That was kind of something I set out to want to get. It was a culmination of like my career, having my family there, my parents, my brothers, and having like everybody almost cheering for you in a sense at this moment in time in my life. It was something I'll never forget because I remember what it was like to be on the outside, what it was like to not be on the baseball team and to be finally on the other side at the finish line in a way. It was special for me having a jersey with my number on it, with my last name on it. That meant a lot because it was an external, I guess, like a hat tip to my family, my parents. they spent so much time and so much effort. That was a tip off to my brothers. Like, took me to baseball practice. Iron sharpens iron. That was probably the biggest moment of my life.
Yeah, that's great. Well, so you wrapped up your baseball career, and now you're on to something really exciting. Tell everybody what you're doing here with medical school and where you're going.
Yeah, so I go to Lake Erie College of Osteopathic Medicine. Our mother campus is in Lake Erie in Pennsylvania. They have a branch campus here in Bradenton, and I went there. I chose that location because I wanted to be close to family. It's like 45 minutes away from my hometown. And right now I'm in my third year. I just finished my board examinations for second year. So in medical school, you have to take a lot of board examinations, and we have to pass every single one of them. And so right now I'm on clinical rotations working at the hospital. So right now I'm on geriatrics rotation. In my third year, we do different specialties. So last one, I did family medicine. Right now I'm doing geriatrics. Next one, I'll do cardiology. And so, yeah, I'm in the clinic seeing patients, helping them with whatever medical issue they have, and kind of enjoying the process while I have it.
Yeah, that's exciting. It's not easy to be a medical school student. It's not easy to get in. And then once you're, you know, that's only half the battle. It's it's admirable what you're doing. I know you're putting in a lot of time. Congratulations on passing those second year boards.
Thank you.
And yeah, and a lot of people are looking forward to see, a lot of our listeners are looking forward to seeing you be a doctor one day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I definitely can't wait. I think representation in medicine is huge on my heart. I'm a very like hard on the table kind of person, and I've noticed there are cultural barriers in medicine, and the vulnerability a patient has based off of culture, language, skin color. There's a lot of things that come into play as far as to why a patient will feel more comfortable with you as a physician, or the dynamic between patient and physician is a lot more streamlined. And I want to help improve that.
Yeah,
especially
and that's a
for
good
Laotians.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I noticed, for example, with the coronavirus pandemic, Cohen, I don't know if you noticed this in your family, a lot of Lao people ended up in the hospital dying. There was actually an article in the paper about in Sioux City, Iowa, a church that was primarily Lao, 18 people died in a matter of like a month. I think it's just so what you can do there to encourage people to look out for their health, right? Get those annual appointments, take care of themselves. It would go a long way, you know.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and definitely what you're doing in the medical field, and then what your brother's doing in the psychology fields, and I think, you know, Asians we don't talk. Right, we don't express our feelings. We're told to hold it in, and I learned that at a very young age. Right, coming here at 4 years old, and you know, people are making fun of me, calling me names, and you run back to tell the parents, and like they really couldn't say much because they were going through the same thing. They were probably getting, you know, called funny names and stuff, and the bottom line on, you know, the tip I got, that I kind of it developed me was that you just deal with it, and you never, you know, I didn't have a voice, right, at a very young age. I was just like, so that affected me into my adulthood. Right? Even though I was a successful bodybuilder and I was winning shows, I still had a hard time. Like, I didn't do very well in the politics game because I didn't know how to express myself. You know, if you gave me second, then well, you know, any second, you know, a lot of guys were speaking up, says, why did I get second? And, you know, and they're bringing out valid points. I just like, you know, when I took second, I walked, you know, onto the next show, and I never really developed that rapport. Again, not having that voice, you know, so I think with you guys and what you're doing, you know, being their voice for maybe the older generation that, like in this case, they didn't know to go and get help, or didn't know what to do.
And if you decide you want to go into ear, nose, and throat ENT, we know a guy, the comic doc Vin Pomachan. Right there, he lives right there in Florida. So you got a mentor down there. He's a Laotian guy who's a comedian.
I have tinnitus too. That's what I was going to ask you. Do you study that do you do ear, nose, and throat? Like, is that a part of your course?
Mm-hmm. Yep. We have in our first 2 years we learned preclinical medicine. So a lot of it is pathology, kind of preparing us for the clinical rotations when we actually see it in front of us. We have to learn about the pathophysiology, the biology, treatment, or anything, you name it. But tinnitus, do you have ringing in your right ear only?
On both, and it's just literally getting worse than like over the past 3-4 years. And it's unfortunate because all I hear is like, there's no cure. And like, I've seen like 3 ENTs, mm-hmm. and one of them was, they actually developed like a hearing aid for me that played sounds, you know, so that helped for a little bit. But you know, you're talking about YouTube and your dad, right? You can look up YouTube and like there's channels that play these sounds that will help you relax and help you go to bed, you know, so some of that is cool. But yeah, I would like to see that a cure is somewhere around the corner. Mm-hmm. That'd be nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, medicine is ever changing, and honestly, maybe soon there might be, for sure.
I hope so.
Yeah, for sure. Well, hey, David, this was a great interview. We were really excited after talking to your brother to get you on here to tell the rest of the story on the two baseball brothers that so many people have sent us messages about, you know, how proud of you guys that they are out there. So keep up the good work. Look forward to seeing what you do in the future here.
Yeah,
I'd really like to commend you on your maturity, on how you viewed things, you know, starting how, like, you know, you didn't take things for granted. Like every day could, you know, today could be the last day. So showing that type of appreciation, your mindset, doing that versus someone that's taking it for granted, like, wow, I'm great, and you know, 5 years from now I'm gonna be this and that, and you know, and then an injury comes along the way and they lose it, right? And they don't know how to deal with it. So for you to have that mindset about just appreciating the day and like, yeah, may not be here, this opportunity may not be here tomorrow. I think that's probably what made your time, you know, playing baseball more rewarding, more enjoyable. So definitely got a great, great attitude. You and your brother, man, you guys are.
Thank you.
You guys are, I don't know, man, you guys are always smiling. You guys are like, he's kind of like, you guys got this like positive energy when you come on. So it's really cool.
Yeah. I'll say about Dave is he has a better choice in schools because he went to UNLV in Vegas where I went. So, but other than that, you guys are both awesome. So. Well, hey, thanks so much for coming on. Hey, everybody, that concludes this episode of the C4 Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Remember to follow us on Facebook, Instagram. This is available on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, and all the other podcast platforms. So see you again. Thanks.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for having me.
The C4 Podcast is brought to you by the Lao American Sports Hall of Fame. Visit us on the web at laoamericansports.com. Celebrating the first, inspiring the next.